Hi, this is Dr. Ronald Hoffman. Many of us wonder sometimes what's going on with our brains, like when we can't recall a name that should be totally familiar to us or forget why we went into the kitchen. These worries take on a little more weight as we grow older. That's why I've created the Intelligent Medicine Brain Health Protocol, my personal supplement recommendations to slow cognitive decline and enhance memory and mental performance. Just go to drhoffmanstore.com. In addition to the Brain Health Protocol, you'll find easy-to-follow links for my Supplement Starter Kit, Heart Health Protocol, and much more. These protocols are an easy way for you to get the exact combination of targeted supplements you need to help you follow the intelligent medicine lifestyle. And for a limited time, you'll get free shipping on all of your store orders. For more details, just go to drhoffmanstore.com. That's drhoffmanstore.com. Welcome to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman. And once again, it's time for our weekly Q&A with Layla, wherein we answer your questions. Your questions can come to us via radioprogram@AOL.com. That's radioprogram@AOL.com. And with us today is our nutritionist in residence, Layla Mudin. She's got a RD certification, as well as a master's degree in the field of nutrition. Eminently qualified to answer any question that we come our way. I feel more secure with you.
Oh, good.
You know, because
I want you to feel secure.
Yeah, because I mean, somebody throws me a curveball, and it's like, you know, but I've got a professional nutritionist backing me up. That's great.
Well, so, don't forget, you're a certified nutrition specialist.
I am a CNS. Yeah. I am a CNS, a certified nutrition specialist. Uh-huh. Also, central nervous system, which means very brainy.
Right.
It's like, I like that. It's like MD CNS. He must be smart. He's got a CNS. He has a central nervous system.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's good to have that. Got to have a pulse, got to have a central nervous system, and then you can render nutritional advice.
And then you could send questions.
Okay. So let's get to questions. Before we do that, let's celebrate a milestone for health freedom. The Farm Bill, which is a monstrosity of a bill because it's always buried in the, there's all kinds of nightmarish things in the Farm Bill, you know, like subsidies to the sugar manufacturers that keep the price of sugar, artificially, low by encouraging sugar manufacture, you know, so that more people can get diabetes. Then also there was on the table was, reform of the SNAP program, the food stamp program.
Yes.
Supplemental nutritional assistance program. Mm-hmm. That didn't really take off. You know, so basically, I don't know, maybe there were some tweaks to it, but you basically can buy any kind of crap with your food stamps these days.
It's unfortunate.
Which is unfortunate because we really would like to see some incentivization towards healthier food. I'm not sure about the details, but the big thing is industrial hemp will be legalized. Now, it was in sort of a quasi-legal realm, and you were able to get CBD, cannabidiol.
Yeah.
But this should really move forward the CBD industry, of which we are a part, because CB Sciences is one of our great sponsors. Really, really happy to have gotten their sponsorship for this program, and they make a wonderful array of cannabidiol products, which are also inclusive of the rich polyphenol compounds and other what are called entourage compounds found in hemp. Hemp is a natural anti-inflammatory.
Yeah.
It's great for a variety of applications, and you know, not just for anxiety and sleep, for pain.
Yeah. So this doesn't mean they've legalized pot.
No. We're just talking hemp.
Yeah, we're
but
just talking hemp.
It eliminates a little bit of a technical obstacle to production of CBD, which, you know, I don't really know, don't quote me on this, but I think a lot of the suppliers were getting outside of the country sources and importing it because there was some issues with growing it here. However, I mean, you do see hemp protein powder, and you do see hemp sandals organic and clothing.
Clothing, organic hemp linen shirts, and right, all of that kind of thing, so, which is quite nice.
So anyway, it's encouraging development. So let's get to questions, please.
Oh, we've got one from Bill. Bill writes, any recommendations for replacing omeprazole? I tried stopping, but paid a price.
That's a rebound reflux. A popular PPI, one of the most widely prescribed medications in the country for any manner of upper GI disturbances, whether it's heartburn, now called GERD, reflux, ulcers.
Yeah.
And in my mind, highly over-prescribed. And, you know, so what's the reason to go off it? Because it does provide relief for some people. Well, what's the problem? I mean, if you're going to get some, you know, relief of your symptoms and you can eat whatever you want, you can eat, you know, that pizza and you can eat that, you know, chili dog with mustard at the ballpark and no problem.
And eat all the hot food, hot and spicy
foods. No problem,
would bother you.
Well,
omeprazole is not supposed to be taken for longer than about 6 weeks, maybe 2 months tops. But people are being prescribed for a lifetime.
Oh, and the disturbing trend is also that omeprazole and medications like it are among the most highly prescribed medications for infants. There's a lot of infant GERD, which could be addressed with diet changes and or behavioral changes, you know, like making sure that the kid's, you know, sitting up and not lying down, you know, bottle
after
propping
eating.
And that whole thing.
And not slumped over.
But anyway, it's highly prescribed inappropriately for long periods of time. Doctors say no problem, you can be on it for life. It is associated with kidney failure, associated with cardiovascular risk. It's associated with dementia.
Yeah.
It's certainly associated with SIBO, small intestine bacterial overgrowth.
Yeah. Yeah.
So much so that when you take a SIBO test, they tell you to get off your PPI. Well, unfortunately, a lot of people can't get off their PPI before they take a breath test that shows excess hydrogen production due to bacterial proliferation. That almost is invariably what happens when you take these medications. So you might take care of the upper GI, but then you get gas and bloating in the lower GI.
Because it changes the pH.
Changes the pH.
We
you
need
don't digest
acid.
Properly. You don't digest. You have undigested food going in.
When your acid is being shut down, your stomach acid is being shut down, you're not going to digest and absorb properly.
So many problems associated with it. And, you know, I've written articles enumerating the problems.
Yeah.
How do you get off? Well, it's tough to get off because you get hooked. Your body becomes used to it. You get what's called rebound hyperacidity, which makes it hard to discern whether you really need it or whether it's you're experiencing the rebound, the symptoms of excess acid due to a prolonged suppression of acid. Then it comes back, you know, like basically it's like, you know, a rubber band that snaps back.
Yeah.
You get excess production of hydrochloric acid for a while until it adjusts and equilibrates and comes back down. So the strategy is to use dietary methods, natural supplements, and occasionally what I'll tell patients to taper very slowly. I'll say take the omeprazole 2 out of every 3 days for a really long time, for a month, you know, because you want to get used to it. Then take it every other day. Then take a 1 out of every 3 days, and then finally go off.
Yeah.
And if necessary, take a less potent acid blocker,
like
Zantac or Pepcid. These are older fashioned medications that may somewhat reduce the stomach acid and act as kind of an auxiliary medication while you're tapering off the other.
Yeah, yeah, good idea. Very important to follow a GERD diet. Very important. There's a whole list of foods to avoid. It's not just the common spicy stuff or the deep fried, very greasy or fatty, but things like chocolate, coffee, tea, tomatoes, bananas, raw onions. There's a whole lot of things. Mints as well. Mint can weaken the lower esophageal sphincter.
So we put people on the GERD diet. But part of the GERD diet, and this is something that was discovered at the Atkins Center, you know, they're putting a lot of people on very low carbohydrate diets for diabetes.
Yeah.
And they would come back and say, oh, you know, your cholesterol's better, your blood sugar's better. Oh, doc, let me tell you, it's been great for my digestion.
Yeah.
I'm not having that heartburn that I used to have. So what's going on with that?
They're not eating bread.
They're not eating fermentable carbohydrates.
They're not eating fermentable carbohydrates. They're avoiding gluten. It's imperative to avoid gluten, too. But on a very low-carb diet, if you've ever embarked on one, after a time, all these symptoms go away, you feel better, And then you invariably cheat with a sandwich or a slice of toast or a pastry or something like
that. You said that like a real New York sandwich.
Yeah.
A sandwich.
Sandwich. Sandwich. Did I say sandwich? I say that to my husband.
Here.
I'm like, honey, you want soup and a sandwich?
We're going to get the
sandwich.
The grammar Nazis are going to be on us here.
No. Soup and a Sammy, right, as Rachel Ray would say. Okay. Anyway. So,
do you know there are people who actually use our podcast to learn proper English pronunciation?
I'm so not a good role model.
We're doing them a disservice. We have people in Yugoslavia and Asia and I listen, Dr. Hoffman. I listen in order to learn English.
How to better. Say sandwich?
Right,
sandwich.
Okay. So anyway, let's not let those people down.
Right.
So.
What happens is, invariably, you'll have a sandwich, a slice of bread, a pastry, and the GERD comes roaring back in full force and maybe even worse because you felt so much better that when it does come back, it often does feel worse than when you've had it chronically.
So, okay, so, supplements that help that.
DGL.
DGL, which is...
Deglycerinated licorice. Deglycerinated.
Deglycerinated.
Deglycerinated. I'll see.
Deglycerinated.
Okay.
Deglycerinated.
DGL.
Okay, because what's removed is the glycyrrhizin.
Yeah, the glycyrrhizic acid.
You deglycerinize it. Mm-hmm. Okay, so you take it out. So it's DGL. Let's forget the full name.
Right.
DGL is a really nice natural anti-inflammatory but the trick is some people say, well, I took a couple and it didn't really help.
Oh, you got to take about 10.
Yeah, you just really suck on these like a candy virtually all day long. Mm-hmm. Other things that are helpful, aloe juice or aloe gel.
Aloe gel,
we like the company Lily of the Desert. Which use free of preservatives because the preservatives can burn, can be irritating.
We like Endorphin powder.
Endorphin, which contains DGL, but other things too.
DGL, it's got some slippery elm and some EGCG and apple powder and astaxanthin and other emollients.
People really like that product.
They
order some. How do you take it, Endorphin?
Endorphin, you take 2 level tablespoons and enough water to dissolve twice a day.
It's kind of gloppy.
Yeah, it's kind of gloppy. Preferably in between meals. Mm-hmm.
And the aloe is best taken like at bedtime and on a rising.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Obviously on an empty stomach.
Yeah.
So you have to be patient because once you've been on a PPI for a really long time, you're going to get some rebound and you have to kind of work through that. So go very gradually. Never go cold turkey on PPI.
No.
And, in order for it to work, you need all those elements together.
Yes, yes. And another word about drugs like omeprazole and other PPIs, when we don't make enough stomach acid, we don't digest and absorb, as we said earlier. But a lot of these folks, if they've been on a PPI for years, they can wind up with osteoporosis.
They have magnesium deficiency, they have B12 deficiency, leading to dementia.
Exactly. So it's best to get all of those things checked out. But it can be done, Bill. You can get off omeprazole.
Oh, we've had many patients doing that. It's one of our specialties here is getting patients off PPIs. Mm-hmm. It's really, it's called deprescribing.
Yeah.
And deprescribing, I think, is a real art. It's to the art of getting people off of medications.
Yeah.
Because it's easy to put people on medications, and they get transient relief, and it's like, then they're stuck. But deprescribing, getting people off statins, getting people off any hypertensive medication that's unnecessary, getting people off these acid blockers, getting people off psychiatric medications that are unnecessary, getting people off
diabetes medicines when they get their blood sugars under control.
Yeah,
all that.
Yeah, it's great. I mean, that's almost like a whole specialty unto itself.
So, Bill, best of luck to you. And if you're in the tri-state area, you can call and make an appointment for a consult.
Get a little guidance,
Get a little guidance. It's one of the best things to do. Okay. We have an email from John. What do you recommend for the prostate? Also, if a person has cancer cells in their prostate but hasn't full growth cancer cells and is 79 years old, do you think that person should just live his life out and probably die of something else?
Well, that's a couple of questions there. You know, I presume he's been told he has precancerous cells. He had a biopsy?
Probably.
Okay. We don't know. Or maybe he's just apprehensive that he might have that. And it's very high likelihood that at 79 he has some precancerous cells. Okay. This is also seems to be the case with other cancers, even breast cancer, where it's been found that they may be early precancers developing in women's breasts that may they may go on to full-blown metastatic life-threatening cancer, or they may be handled by the body's immune system. There's a series of editing steps that our bodies are capable of performing to slow the progression to cancer. Cancer's not just a one-off, you know, like a cell is normal and then one mutation and boom, you have like cancer. Right. It requires a series of steps. You know, it's much like, you know, when you analyze the cause of a plane crash, you know, it's like, it's usually not like one thing. It's like, you know, there was some faulty maintenance and then there was, you know, some stress due to weather conditions, maybe improper de-icing and then an improper crew response and maybe...
It's like the perfect storm.
Right, the perfect storm. So and that's the way cancer develops.
Yeah.
Is a series of missteps that allow the proliferation of cells in an uncontrolled way. So it...
And a weakened immune system, as will happen with a 79-year-old. Elderly. It's
And
young kids.
So... The, you know, and living long offers more of an opportunity for cells to mutate in the wrong direction. So, you know, studies actually show that at autopsy, you know, if you do autopsies on men's prostates after death, very high percentage of men in that age group have some areas of prostate cancer, which ultimately are undetected but may not have killed them. And
yes,
like he says,
they died of something else.
Absolutely.
Just like when they do autopsies on women and they find DCIS in their breasts, but they died of something else.
Right. It's the prostate. Sometimes I tell men, that's the prostate cancer that's going to kill you when you're 120.
Right.
You know? And so, now, what are some of the steps we can take to slow the progression of prostate cancer? Well, there's so many, certainly from the standpoint of diet. It's a little controversial what type of diet is the best for prostate cancer prevention, but I would say, plant-based is a good basis. The question is whether you can enjoy some saturated fat and some animal products. Some people think that animal products are what cause prostate cancer. Others think that it's the carbohydrates in the diet that drive cancer development. But I have to say, it is controversial. There's also some...
specifically for prostate cancer.
Yeah, and there's also some knocks on dairy as maybe a promoter of prostate cancer.
Those growth factors, IGF-1.
And it may be not dairy per se, but what's in the dairy these days that is a hormonal effect. So yes, organic foods, no xenoestrogens.
A very, very clean whole foods diet.
Yeah, and so...
Limiting sugar.
Supplements that prevent vitamin D. There's been some doubt cast on vitamin E and selenium due to a study done at Hutchinson in Seattle.
That was the bad vitamin E. It was only alpha tocopherol.
And it wasn't the right selenium, possibly. But these days we favor tocotrienols for mixed. There's 8 components to tocotrienols. Four tocotrienols and 4 forms of vitamin E, and that mixed mixed tocopherol, mixed tocotrienol combination seems to be preventive. There's EGCG, there's the sulforaphane, there's DIM.
What about pumpkin seed oil and stinging nettle? So, how important?
More for prostatitis, though.
Yeah, more for prostatitis. How important is saw palmetto?
Saw palmetto is a bit of a mimic of the effects of Proscar, finasteride, which have been shown to reduce the incidence of prostate cancer. But when you get the prostate cancer, it might be worse. So there's kind of a mixed bag on that. In other words, it's a bit of a blocker, but if you get past that step in the cancer mutation, then the cancer might be more aggressive. So I don't.
But you get to keep the hair on your head.
Possibly you do. Yeah, I mean there may be some hair benefits to these 5 alpha reductase inhibitors. So among other things, there's some controversy about whether omega-3 is preventive, but I think omega-3 is preventive for prostate cancer.
Anything anti-inflammatory, an anti-inflammatory diet, anti-inflammatory supplements, everything starts with inflammation.
Yep.
So targeting inflammation is always a good idea.
And there's also some question about soy. And, you know, while a lot of people have intolerance to soy, there really is some evidence that genistein from soy may have a protective effect in prostate cancer.
The phytoestrogens would be beneficial, too, if it's going to block any excess testosterone.
And if you have active prostate cancer, modified citrus pectin, or MCP, is also favored.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's some of the, really that's scratching the surface. I wrote, about a 3 or 4 part article on prostate cancer a couple of years ago. Maybe it's time
to revive it. Yeah.
But it, you know, looked at all the various plausible things you can do to slow the progression of prostate cancer. And if you just think, prostate cancer is one of those things where you can actually watch it. Even if it's diagnosed. If it's an early prostate cancer, you can do what's called active holistic surveillance. And that means not treating it with radiation, not treating it with
prostatectomy,
and watching it. And we have several patients who are successful with that, who are using this diet and lifestyle approach along with supplements, and subsequent prostate biopsies are coming up negative, which shows that the early cancer can be controlled. It's really a remarkable example of how natural therapies can, you know, save a lot of suffering because, you know, when you do radiation, when you do prostatectomy, there's always some consequences.
Yeah.
You know, whether it's to potency or urinary frequency.
It seems that the risk factor for prostate cancer is being an elderly man.
Yeah.
What other, I can't imagine any type of exposure or...
Well, obesity is a risk factor. It's certainly a risk factor. Yeah, and that's why, you know... And I think there's also some evidence that diabetes is a risk factor because of the IGF-1, the insulin-like growth factor that gets generated. So, you know, physical activity or inactivity, sedentary lifestyle is a risk factor. And, you know, we encourage our men with prostate cancer to adopt exercise programs. Gio Espinosa's written a nice book on cancer, prostate cancer. He's the naturopathic urologist, and that's his focus.
Yeah.
And I'm pleased to say we just agree down the line on, you know, how to handle it.
That's Gio Espinosa. He's down at NYU.
He's at NYU, and I think he also has a private practice in Connecticut.
So, John, thank you for this question. All right. We have one from Charlie. How much calcium is recommended for a man in his late 70s, especially after surgery? He doesn't say the type of
surgery. The type of surgery, you know, if it's like some kind of bone surgery, we might recommend some calcium. But generally, what's our feeling about calcium for men?
It's not a great idea. It may not be great for the prostate. There's a study, this came out when I was in graduate school.
Or for the heart,
Or for the heart. So any calcium that's in a multi, I imagine, would be just fine.
Yeah.
It's not going to overload. It's
probably
going to be
200 up to 400 milligrams of elemental calcium.
But we don't ever recommend 1,200 or 1,500 milligrams of calcium anymore for anyone.
Yeah, and even for women, are
there's
really not a lot of evidence that loading with calcium is going to make your bones stronger.
Right.
And there's evidence that it may get into the arteries, too.
Yeah, I like to say that we don't make the house stronger by adding more shingles.
Well, you want to know because you're working on a house.
Right? Yeah, but we're not at the shingle point yet. But here's the thing. I mean, look at your blood test. A metabolic panel is going to show your calcium level. If it's in the normal range, there's no reason to add more calcium.
Right.
Meanwhile, people are low in magnesium. They're low in vitamin D.
Right.
They could do better with their vitamin K, et cetera, et cetera.
It is very rare to see people with what's called hypocalcemia, low calcium. Much more common to see hypercalcemia due to a parathyroid adenoma, but hyperparathyroidism. But hypoparathyroidism, very rare condition where there's low blood calcium. And so generally, there's the body, through a homeostatic mechanism, absorbs the calcium that it needs from diet. unless you're on an extremely poor diet, you're going to get some calcium in your diet and some additional calcium.
It is an electrolyte, so it will be present. It's absolutely necessary. Your electrolytes are calcium, magnesium, sodium, and potassium. So there is that.
The calcium. Yeah, so I don't see it as a big, you know, we do have a section in our popular section, supplements for surgery. Calcium's not one of them.
No. Magnesium does get low.
Yeah, because of the
surgery,
stress.
Surgery, trauma, all of that.
Yeah, I had that when I had my hip fracture. I had famously low magnesium, which is...
Well, great. I remember you telling me that you kept telling them, my magnesium is going to be low.
Yeah.
My magnesium is going to be low. You should give me some magnesium. And then finally...
It was like
four days later, your magnesium's low.
Right. They said, well, we can't give you magnesium until we test it. Okay, we'll test it. Okay. Oh, okay. They're going to humor this guy. Like, you know, he's delirious. He's in pain, you know. We'll draw magnesium. So about 2-3 days later, so I'm wake up in my, you know, groggy state on pain medications in my hospital room. And I asked the nurse, because I routinely ask them, what are you putting in my bag?
Great idea.
You know, it's like, oh, aren't you that cancer patient? No, that's right. You know. I said, this is a little bag of magnesium. I said, that's great. When did they decide to give me magnesium? He says, oh, I don't know. The nurse said, the resident will come by tomorrow and tell you. So I asked the resident, who looked like he was about, you know, 19 years old, you know, barely shaving, you know, the little short white jacket. And I said, I noticed you gave me magnesium last night. He says, yeah, you know, your magnesium was low. And I said, you know, you really ought to read up on trauma and the effects of trauma on magnesium. Because I was in kind of shock when I came in. I was injured and in shock. And
magnesium, then you had surgery. That's another trauma.
And magnesium would have really alleviated some of that distress. Mm-hmm. And he said, really, are there peer-reviewed articles on it? I said, yes, there are. Look them up, please. You know, and, you
go to PubMed. Hello.
And he sounded like, you know, this guy, this bleary-eyed looking guy with his leg in a, you know, in a sling there. You know, what does he know?
Golly.
You know, but anyway.
Yeah.
So much for that. All right, so... we're going to pause because we divide our podcast into two parts. So give us a preview of what we're going to talk about in part two.
Is there a way to test the degree of allergic reaction other than using a pulse rate?
Oh, very interesting. Okay. We will tackle that rather wonky question in part two of today's Q&A with Layla. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, radio program at AOL.com, the destination for questions. Get in the action by sending us your question to radioprogram@AOL.com. We'll be right back. This is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.